From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two great actors starring in summer films. We'll hear from Lawrence Fishburne, star of What's Love Got to Do with It and Searching for Bobby Fischer. And we'll hear an interview with Joe Mantegna, also starring in Searching for Bobby Fischer. It's part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives. Is Searching for Bobby Fischer worthy of these two actors' talents? Our film critic Stephen Schiff will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The agreement struck last night on the side deals to the North American Free Trade Agreement will exempt Canada from trade sanctions if the rules on the environment and labor are broken. This after weeks of negotiations during which the Canadian delegates refused to even consider sanctions, which they claim could be used as a protectionist tool by the United States. John Halber reports Canada will still be held accountable and fined for violations of the side deals.
Canada's International Trade Minister, Tom Hawking, said today was a great day for Canada, which had stood up to the demands of the United States that sanctions be part of the side deals to NAFTA. Last night, Prime Minister Kim Campbell personally called Mexican President Carlos Salinas to explain her government's position. She said the United States has a long history of using obscure clauses in the 1989 Free Trade Agreement for protectionist purposes, and that no such clauses would be supported by Canada in NAFTA. Today, the Canadian business community is happy that Canada didn't budge, but last night's agreement means Canada will have to change its laws to deal with violations to the environment and labor side deals through its own court system, and if necessary, to pay fines of up to $20 million. For National Public Radio, this is John Halber in Toronto.
President Clinton pledged today to make the San Francisco Bay Area a national model for defense conversion. The president's pledge came on the second day of a tour to promote his $19 billion defense conversion plan. Sally Isley of member station KQED reports.
In a speech at the Alameda Naval Air Station, the president acknowledged that Northern California will be the hardest hit region in the country by the latest round of base closures. But Mr. Clinton pledged an aggressive federal assistance program to translate military job losses into private sector opportunities.
I make this pledge to you. The men and women who won the Cold War will not be left out in the cold by a grateful nation.
The small city of Alameda, almost entirely dependent on the military, is expected to lose hundreds of jobs when the Naval Air Station closes. The president pledged $3.5 million to help with the initial conversion. The city's mayor said he was encouraged by that, but added, regardless, his region will go through a lot of economic turmoil before the conversion is complete. For National Public Radio, I'm Sally Isley in Alameda.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street, despite a report that consumer prices rose less than expected in July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about half a point to close at 3,569.5. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 1.1 to 718.2. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 213 million shares. This is NPR News. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic said today that the first priority at next week's Bosnian peace talks must be an end to the Serbian siege of Sarajevo. The talks were postponed until Monday, pending a resolution of the dispute over a Serbian withdrawal from strategic mountain positions overlooking the Bosnian capital. UN officials in Sarajevo now say that the Serbs have agreed to withdraw their forces to a compromise line and allow the mountain positions to be occupied by UN peacekeepers. The Serbs have reportedly promised to pull back by tomorrow afternoon. The FBI says it's investigating the death of Michael Jordan's father as a possible kidnapping. Kathy Merritt of member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, reports.
Agent Thomas Lusby from the Bureau's Charlotte office says investigators are operating on the possibility that the 57-year-old Jordan was abducted and taken across state lines. Lusby says that's based on the fact that James Jordan's body was recovered in South Carolina, while his car was found 60 miles away in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Lusby says the case will be difficult because there was a delay between the probable time of Jordan's death and the discovery of the body. Authorities say he died of a bullet wound to the chest. Lusby said he spoke with members of the Jordan family today. James Jordan had been missing for 3 weeks. He was last seen attending a funeral in North Carolina. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The case of two Detroit police officers charged in the beating death of a black man went to two juries today. Officers Walter Budson and Larry Nevers are charged with beating Malice Green to death with their flashlights during an arrest last November. An autopsy showed that Green died from at least 14 blows to the head, although defense experts testified that cocaine and alcohol contributed to his death. Members of the two juries have now retired for the night. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the summer's most talked-about movie performances is Lawrence Fishburne's portrayal of Ike Turner in What's Love Got to Do with It? Now Fishburne is in another summer film. He co-stars in Searching for Bobby Fischer as a streetwise chess player. Fishburne also starred in Boys in the Hood as the father. You may remember him as Cowboy Curtis on Pee-wee's Playhouse. When he was still in his teens, he appeared in Apocalypse Now as the young soldier in the boat with Martin Sheen. Since he's reached a new level of recognition this summer, we're featuring him as part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives. Here he is in a scene from What's Love Got to Do with It. Ike and Tina Turner are about to perform an important concert. Tina just had a baby. She's been sick and exhausted and doesn't think she can perform. Ike is pushing her to do it.
You got to understand, if we don't get out on that stage tonight, we don't get paid. Yeah? And if we don't get paid, we don't eat.
About me?
What about the band? You talking about the baby in the road and it's all happening too fast. Damn, you got more excuses than a nigga going to jail. You got too many excuses, woman. And this here is about business right here. That marquee out there say Ike and Tina Turner. And the people out there waiting on me and you laying up here talking about you tired. Now, what you gonna do? You wanna take care of business or you looking for a way out? Oh, I see. You wanna leave me like all them other suckers I done made famous.
That's not what I meant.
Well, what you talking about then? Now, we here. We at the place I've been trying to get to my whole life. We got the right song at the right place at the right time. Now, I need you to get out on that stage right now.
I spoke with Lawrence Fishburne in April of 92 after the release of his film Deep Cover. He played an undercover cop posing as a drug dealer. Fishburne's father was a parole officer. I wanted to know if that affected Fishburne's attitude towards cops.
Not so much my attitude towards cops as it was my attitude toward the possibility of winding up in jail.
Right.
I knew that that wasn't a place I wanted to go. My father would often come to me with messages from the young inmates that he was in charge of. And the one message that kept coming to me was that if I ever messed up and wound up in jail, that they would take care of me. So I knew that was a place I didn't want to go.
Did a lot of people assume after Boys in the Hood, in which you played the father, did a lot of people assume that you only wanted to play positive role models after that?
I'm sure a lot of people do think that. I think that there's a need for all that kind of stuff and positive role models and the like, but I have to do things for me. And, you know, we're all not positive role models, you know. And I think my responsibility is to reflect truth wherever I see it. And the truth is not always a positive role model, you know.
I think probably the most interesting roles are also probably not positive role models.
Yeah, you know, some of the most fun are not the role model guys. Absolutely.
A good example is your role in King of New York.
Which I'm very, very proud of.
Yeah. And you were, you know, big drug dealer in that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, he wasn't even a drug dealer. I mean,
just controlled vice.
Christopher Walken's character deals drugs. My character kills people.
Right, okay.
You know,
yeah,
and
right.
And it's the kind of character you see in the movies all the time. For me, he's a classic two-gun kid. The role was written for a white actor, and we get to see white actors occasionally, or more than occasionally, often in movies, run around with two pistols, shooting people, laughing about it, having a good time, and going off scot-free. It's a classic movie type, and it's something I've always wanted to do. I had to campaign very hard to win that role, and I did, and I'm very proud of the work because, you know, I was able to do something that people, because of their color, aren't allowed to do.
You know, I usually hear the opposite complaint from African-American actors, that they have to, that they're tired of being offered the roles of the killers, and you really went after this one.
Yeah, I wasn't even offered it. You see, that was a whole that was a whole problem, you know. They offered me the cop that Wesley Snipes played in that movie, which would have been fun, but I think Jump was a lot more fun. And, you know, I there's a lot of young cats who see the movie who really enjoy it. Not just young people, but, you know, older people, too, who really enjoy the movie, so... I'm really proud of that. I'm just as proud of that as I am of Furious.
The father in Boys in the Hood. Actor Lawrence Fishburne is my guest. You started acting as a child. I think you had your first big role when you were 10. Did you want to act, or was it more your parents' suggestion?
I wanted to be a doctor. Right. And then I wanted to be a basketball player.
Uh-huh.
But by that time, I was 9. And I got my first role professionally when I was 10. I had been doing, you know, plays in school and stuff, you know, from the age of 3, I guess. So the acting came to me naturally, as it does to most children, because children are the best actors. And from the age of 10, after getting my first job, it just kind of... creeped along and build, you know, and kept building and building and building until, you know, here I am 20 years later.
How did you get, what kind of part did you have on One Life to Live, the soap opera, when you were 10?
I was a young orphan, kind of living by his wits on the street, who was found by this police officer breaking into his, into his office. And subsequently got adopted by two black characters who had been romantically involved with one another on this show for many years, and we sort of became the first African-American family on television. Or at least on a soap opera, daytime television, anyway.
That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So did you enjoy it? Did it feel like work or fun?
It felt like fun. I mean, I got to miss school 1 or 2 days out of the week. I got paid a little bit of money.
Did your parents let you keep the money that you earned?
No, that money was put away.
For your college?
Yeah, well, I never went to college, so, you know. But, yeah,
you went to Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
instead.
I went to Apocalypse Now school.
Right. We'll get to that a little bit later.
Sure.
When you started acting as a kid, was your mother with you, or, you know, behind you when you were getting roles
sure.
as a kid?
Sure. She was very much behind me. She was very supportive. In fact, you might even say she was a bit pushy at times.
What would she do when she was pushy?
Well, she would. The pushy stuff was like there'd be auditions for, you know, for musicals and stuff like that, you know, and for really, really commercial kind of things. And even at a very young age, I was not interested in doing very, very commercial things. You know? Not very interested in doing the thing that was going to be popular just based on the material itself, you know? So those kind of things I would resist a lot.
But she'd try to push you into doing them?
Yeah, she'd try and push me into them, and I'd be like, no, I don't think so. I'm not going to do that.
Any big hits that you talked your way out of?
Let's see now. Well, there was a play that was called The Me Nobody Knows.
Oh, I remember that.
That I was like, nah, I don't think I want to do that. Yeah. You know, a few things. I can't remember.
When you were 12, you starred in Cornbread Earl and Me,
right.
Which I never saw. I don't even know
what
it's
no?
about, to tell you the truth.
Oh, it's a great little movie.
After making Cornbread Earl and Me, were you a celebrity in your neighborhood?
I guess I was. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, people used to call me movie star a lot. And they'd say, hey, movie star, how come you dress like a bum?
Were you kind of a bohemian when you were young?
Yeah, I've been a bohemian all my life. John Singleton really, really hit it on the head. John was like, people are like this and that. And John looks at me and goes, Fish is a hippie, man. He's a hippie, you know. So.
Did people in the neighborhood think you should be wearing your money?
Yeah. Yeah, especially the kids.
We're featuring an interview from the archives with Lawrence Fishburne. He's starring in What's Love Got to Do with It and Searching for Bobby Fischer. When he was a teenager, he was featured in Apocalypse Now. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Larry Fishburne is my guest. The movie Apocalypse Now broke the hearts and souls of grown men who were in it. You were 15 when you were cast in that film. You were you were like the kid in the boat taking Martin Sheen down the river. Your mother came with you to the Philippines to shoot the movie, right? How did your father feel? I mean, I'm sure you were expecting to be there for a few months. The movie took, I think, more than 2 years to
Yeah, we were told we were going to be there for 3 months. And we wound up staying the better part of 2 years, 76 and 77.
So the family was divided for that period of time.
Well, you know, the family really, the family unit was my mother and myself. My mother and my father were, you know, divorced when I was very young. So I pretty much grew up with my mother. My father did, though, come over and spend a great deal of time with me. And it was actually for the first time in my life that my father and I lived together was when I was over there. And that was really nice. It was very, very, very nice. So we were actually kind of together rather than that we were divided toward the end of the shooting. I think the last 6 months of the shooting, my father was there with my mother and I, and my mother's new husband, because she had remarried, so.
How did it feel? Here you were working with Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper and Robert Duvall, and you're there with your mom, you know? Did you feel like, Mom, go home?
No, I mean, my mother was a teacher and is a very creative person herself. So she really let me go. I mean, to a large extent. I mean, in that environment, she recognized that her son was now, you know, 6 inches taller than her and was involved in this, you know, pretty serious undertaking. So she didn't try and restrain me in any way. She really let me go.
I'm sure there were a lot of, I mean, I'm guessing, I imagine that there were a lot of drugs on the set, a lot of marijuana and maybe LSD. So when your father was down there, him being a, you know, corrections officer, law enforcement guy, did he turn his head the other way?
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't, not at all. In fact, that was the reason that he came down.
Oh.
Because,
to keep you straight?
Yeah, really, to keep me straight. Because my mother, like I said, she let me go and she couldn't get me back. So she called in the big guns.
So what did he do?
He followed me around everywhere I went, and he carried a big stick. You think I'm kidding?
He really did carry a stick?
He really did.
Did he use it on you?
No. My father's psychological. Psychological. My father's a very big man. He's very big.
Well, did he use that kind of psychological stuff on Dennis Hopper?
No, he didn't have to. He wasn't there for Dennis Hopper. He was there for me. So it worked.
It did?
It worked.
Yeah. Were you afraid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was it like to be 15 years old and working with actors like Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper, who seemed to have kind of flipped, you know? I saw the movie Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, and as extraordinary Brando and Hopper are as actors, they seemed like they were so difficult to work with. And so here you were watching these, like, two great actors behaving bizarrely.
Yeah, yeah, it was very interesting. Fortunately for me, my character is dead by the time we get to see those two guys. So I didn't have to work with them in that way. But as far as behavior, I had never seen anybody behaved the way Dennis Hopper did. And I think we all know that no one behaves the way that Brando does other than Brando. So it was very interesting, and it was, I mean, I was very impressionable, 14, 15. I had never heard of Dennis Hopper. But when I saw him, I had never seen a human being behave that way, and I was like, this is the guy. This is the cat. Forget about Brando. Forget about Sheen. This is the man. I want to be like this man. Because he was just out, you know? He was in a continual state of chaos. He was just amazing to watch. And those were not his best days.
Right.
But in order for him to get where he is, he had to go through that. So, you know, I was very impressed. The whole experience, because I was so young, you see, to me, all of that was normal. It was only my second film. So I came back from that experience thinking, okay, well, this is the way you make movies. You have too much money, you have too much time, and you go completely crazy while you do it.
So how did you change when you tried to model yourself on Dennis Hopper?
Oh, well, you know, I tried to drink as much as I can, and smoke as much reefer as I can, and listen to as much loud music as I can, that kind of stuff.
Your father must have been thrilled.
He was. He was. Well, see, that's why he had to carry a big stick.
Right. So what got you out of that period?
I came home. I came home, and I had to go to high school. You know, I had to, like, finish high school, you know.
God, going to high school after making Apocalypse Now, that must have been
something. It was a joke. It really was. It was quite funny. But Francis was cool. He understood what he had done, you know.
What was the most, I'm sorry, go ahead.
He understood where he had kind of dropped me and what kind of environment he had dropped me in. So I went to go stay with him. He opened a school for gifted youngsters. Actually, the school he said, for kids who want to rule the world. And it was me and his son, and Giancarlo, who has passed away in 86. God bless him. And Mickey Hart's son and some other kids. So we ran around and we were like assistants to all these other people who were doing great things. You know, like I was Wim Wenders' assistant for a while.
Huh.
Which meant I went and got the pizza and the cigars and cleaned up after they had, you know, readings and stuff.
So that's the high school you went to, or did you go to real high school after
that? Well, I went to real high school after that, but, you know, sort of in between going to real high school and graduating, I went to go to this kid, you know, to the school for kids who want to rule the world.
Actor Lawrence Fishburne is my guest. You were a regular on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
You betcha.
You were There you go. You were Cowboy Curtis.
Yes, ma'am. Ooh-wee.
And you had a great animated lasso.
Yes. Magic lasso.
Yeah. How'd you get the part with Pee-wee?
I met Pee-wee in L.A. Back in the early 80s. And he and I became friends, and I was doing Gardens of Stone, and I got this call. He said, I need a black cowboy. So I said, no problem, you know, and I saddled up and rode on in. Kind of where it's at.
Was it fun to work on the show?
It was wonderful.
I love that show.
I mean, it was the first, you know, television show for children that had live people on it for a long time.
Now, you've made two movies with Spike Lee.
Made one with him.
One movie? Mm-hmm. Gee, why am I thinking it's two? It was School Days. What was I thinking of the second?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Was it Do the Right Thing?
No, I know you're not in that.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked to be in that.
I was asked to play Radio Raheem.
Yeah, but you turned it down.
Right.
How come?
I didn't like the part.
Yeah, tell me what you didn't like about it.
Well, I didn't like the script. I grew up in Brooklyn, too. And Radio Raheem, to me, wasn't well-developed as a character. He wasn't defined on the page. And that meant that I had to bring all the stuff to make him human to it. And I felt like I had done enough of that in terms of what I did in School Days for the character of Dap. The problem that I have with Spike's work is that he doesn't do as much rewriting as he could. And he leaves it to the actors to sort of fill in the blanks, which is nice. It's nice to have that kind of freedom. But at the same time, if you're allowed that kind of freedom and the director won't let you in on what his vision is, it's kind of difficult to know what to do. Spike has a ceiling that you can't see about where, about how far he'll let you go. He welcomes your input and he welcomes your improvisation, but to a point. So it's difficult to know how far to go because he won't tell you where, you know, how far you can go. And when things are well defined on the page, then you know how far to go. With Do the Right Thing, we got a script that I think was about 98 to 109 pages, with a character who had no dialogue, who was basically a device to create this big race riot scene at the end. And I'm not really kind of into race riots. I don't think they help anybody, so I passed.
Could you work with Spike Lee after turning down one of his roles?
Could I work with him?
Could you work with him again after that?
That's up to him.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to?
If the material was really good and, you know, if it was something I was interested in doing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked with John Singleton on Boys in the Hood.
Right.
I understand he was a production assistant on Pee-wee's Playhouse, and that's
you
how you met?
You
betcha. It's Cowboy Curtis again.
Yeah.
That was the first script he wrote. Was that well fleshed out?
Very well. It's airtight, watertight. You know, I mean, he wrote it in school, in this dramatic writing program. He won an award for it. He went back and wrote it again, re-entered in the same contest and won the same award again 2 years in a row. He had thought about it for 4 years before he wrote it.
Was there anything about Furious, the father that you played in Boys in the Hood, that reminded you of your own father?
not until I saw the movie a couple of times did I see my father in my performance.
Uh-huh. What was it in your performance that reminded you of him?
There's just a look. There's a way that I hold my face in one particular scene that I went, oh, there's my dad, you know?
Is your mother really pleased with the way your career has turned out? You know, I think of all the child actors I've seen on Entertainment Tonight and all those shows talking mm-hmm. about how they have to be in self-help groups because their lives were so troubled and tragic mm-hmm. after the TV series stopped or whatever.
Right,
and
right.
You've gone on to a real serious, interesting, fine career.
Well, that was the other thing that my mother wanted me to do was be in a series, and that was the thing that, you know, I resisted.
Huh.
And I think it's because of that resistance that I've been able to survive and, you know, have a career as an adult.
Right.
You know, so I hope my mother is pleased.
Larry Fishburne, thanks a lot for talking
with us.
You're
very, very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Fishburne recorded in 1992. He's now starring in What's Love Got to Do With It and Searching for Bobby Fischer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You must understand, the touch of your hand makes my pulse react, that it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to that it means more than that. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Joe Mantegna. He stars in the new film Searching for Bobby Fischer. Mantegna is also probably the leading interpreter of David Mamet's writing. He starred in Mamet's films House of Games and Homicide, and in Mamet's play Glengarry Glen Ross. He also starred in Godfather 3 as Joey Zaza, a mobster with $2,000 suits. A little later, Stephen Schiff will review Mantegna's new film, Searching for Bobby Fischer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Clinton administration today unveiled supplemental accords to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor announced the completion of talks designed to make the controversial trade pact more attractive to skeptical lawmakers. The side agreements between the United States, Canada, and Mexico set up tri-national commissions, which will hear and review complaints that a country is not enforcing its own labor and environmental laws. Mickey Cantor called the side agreements historic.
The NAFTA, with the addition of the supplemental accords, is a groundbreaking agreement. For the first time, a free trade agreement covers workers' rights and the environment. This will serve as a model in the future.
But critics of NAFTA called the complaint procedure flawed and convoluted. AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland denounced the enforcement mechanisms in the side accords as having no teeth. And House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt said he was not optimistic deficiencies in the side agreements can be resolved. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A federal appeals court has ruled unanimously that millions of White House computer messages, as well as paper printouts, must be preserved for posterity. This decision is a landmark ruling in the field of government information at a time when the White House and other government agencies move further into the age of the paperless office. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The appeals court panel upheld a lower court ruling that the Federal Records Act requires the current administration to preserve some 5,000 magnetic tapes and hard disks containing the White House and national security records of the Reagan and Bush administrations. The original ruling, issued by Federal Judge Charles Ritchie, was appealed by the Clinton administration upon taking office in January. The government argued that if a printout existed of a message or a document, there was no need to keep it in computer form. But the appeals court, agreeing with Judge Ritchie, said the electronic data often shows much more information than a printed copy. For example, electronic messages automatically record who received copies of the message, information that can be critical, as it was in the Iran-Contra case. A Justice Department spokesman said the administration is reviewing today's court opinion to see if an appeal should be taken to the Supreme Court. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Somalia, UN officials continue to deny that U.S. troops opened fire on demonstrators yesterday who were throwing stones at them. Instead, UN military spokesmen say that those wounded, most likely, were hit by bullets from their fellow protesters. Leaders of the protest said at least three Somalis were wounded, but UN officials said that soldiers fired above their heads. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,569.65 on volume of more than 213 million shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, UN officials say that Serbian forces have agreed to leave a key mountain area outside of Sarajevo by sometime tomorrow afternoon. At the same time, a buffer zone between opposing forces has been agreed upon, and it will be guarded by UN troops. UN officials call the step a breakthrough and say it will allow peace talks in Geneva to resume Monday. Up to now, it's been hard to tell if Serbian forces had met their agreement to pull back because of a shortage of UN peacekeepers. As many as 100 people are feared dead after a popular tourist hotel collapsed in northern Thailand. Several hundred people were inside the building when its upper stories caved in. Alan Pierce reports for the BBC.
So far, at least 350 people have been treated at one local hospital, but many others are thought to remain trapped beneath the rubble. The scene here is one of sheer pandemonium. Heavy lifting equipment, cranes and bulldozers are struggling to clear away the debris. But the sheer noise of the operation preventing rescuers from listening to the sounds of any survivors buried beneath. Army engineers are pumping oxygen into the ruins in the hope of keeping any survivors alive. But rescue workers say the chances of finding more people alive are diminishing. A steady stream of ambulances is continuing to arrive at the scene. Every 20 minutes or so, another body is placed aboard and driven away. Eyewitnesses say the Royal Plaza Hotel collapsed in upon itself like a house of cards.
Alan Pierce reporting for the BBC in Korat, Thailand. The Labor Department says consumer prices moved up a slight 0.1% last month, in part because of rising medical expenses. The government says in the first 7 months of the year, consumer prices have gone up 2.8%. Food prices last month were virtually unchanged. Lettuce prices jumped nearly 16%, but tomato prices dropped more than 32%. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, Searching for Bobby Fischer, is about a chess prodigy. Joe Mantegna plays the boy's father. As part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives, we're going to hear an interview with Mantegna recorded in 1991, soon after his roles in Godfather III and Homicide. Mantegna is probably the leading interpreter of David Mamet's writing. Mantegna starred on Broadway in Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross and Speed the Plow. He starred in Mamet's films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide. Mamet writes dialogue that turns colloquial speech into poetry. Here's a scene from House of Games. Mantegna plays a con man who has been teaching some of his cons to a psychiatrist played by Lindsay Krause.
Give me your hand. Think of a finger. Think of one. You thinking of one?
Yes.
Okay. I'm gonna tell you which finger you're thinking of. Do you think I can do that? This one.
Yes, how did you know?
How did I know? Because you were thinking of it. Do you want to make love with me?
Excuse me?
Because you're blushing. That's a tell. The things we think, the things we want, we could do them or not do them, but we can't hide them.
What is it you think I want?
I'll tell you. Somebody to come along. Somebody to possess you. To take you into a new thing. Would you like that? Do you want that?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes.
That's good.
I wanted to know if Mantegna thinks of his lines in a musical way, and if he thinks out where the accents will fall in each line.
I studied acting for a couple of years at the Goodman School of Drama, which was the Goodman School of Drama, is now DePaul University here in Chicago. And one of the more beneficial courses there was, you know, scoring a script and being able, in other words, to take the material and read it like a piece of music and understand, make notations and understand that if when you're given a certain sentence, there's a variety of ways that sentence could be delivered, depending, of course, on which word you're going to emphasize or just the lilt of your voice or this, that, and the other. Because David Mamet has obviously put a lot of attention into writing just the right wording and the right punctuation to get his point across.
Do you ever improvise within a Mamet script, or is everything, you know, as it is in the text?
Well, I would say that improvisation in terms of the dialogue is pretty minimal and should be.
Why should it be?
Because you wouldn't. Some writers write with the freedom for verbal improvisation in there. I've worked for Woody Allen. Now with Woody, he will give you that freedom. In other words, but it's intentional. In other words, Woody will write his dialogue, but it isn't written totally in stone. And of course, coming from working a lot with Mamet, as I have, my initial reaction when I first was working with Woody was I would give him exactly every word he has written it. You know, I'd improvise in terms of my delivery and things like that, as I do with any material. But he, early on, like at first or second day of shooting, I remember him saying to me, he says, oh, listen, Joe, you know, don't feel like you're locked to these words. You know, if you want to add some stuff or you just want to go with it or, you know, change this, that, or the other, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And so, oh, well, okay, once I had that signal from him, then there were instances where I would, you know, vamp or riff or whatever words you want to use for it as to making alterations as to what I'm saying. But that's Woody's style. That's the way he works, and that's how he writes. Of course, if he wasn't getting what he wanted, he'd be the first one to say, well, maybe don't say that. Say something else.
Right.
But where with David, it's a different ballgame because he just writes differently. He's a man who has specifically, I mean, he writes in iambic pentameter, so it's not unless a person naturally speaks that way, it would be a little risky to just say, well, I know you wrote this line, Dave, but I think I'll say it this way.
My guest is actor Joe Mantegna. He's currently starring in Searching for Bobby Fischer. He starred in many David Mamet films and plays and co-starred in Woody Allen's film Alice. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1991 interview with Joe Mantegna recorded after his film Homicide. Is Homicide written in iambic pentameter?
I mean, I haven't sat down with a metronome and counted out, but I would say yes. I mean, I would think that everything he's written is within those rhythms. I mean, I don't know how strictly he adheres to it, and it's not important. It's a thing that's just there, and it's part of the beauty of the material.
Well, you know, you play a cop who's very alienated both from, I mean, the guy's got no family, he's got no personal life, he's really seems to have no friends outside of his partner, and he's even alienated from a lot of the cops that he works with. And in the last scene particularly, all of that alienation, because there's been a couple of final betrayals, really register on your face. And I was really wondering what you were thinking about during the shooting of that last scene, to get that kind of dazed alienation on your face.
Well, I tell you, it all led toward that. I mean, playing that role, it was a monumental role for me. It was the most difficult role I've ever played, and certainly in film. Partly because I'm in, outside of the first minute of the movie, I'm in every frame, and that translates into working 12-hour days, day in, day out, consistently, week after week, under very harsh conditions, in very unpleasant environments, dealing with some very serious and disturbing things. And that starts to wear on you after a while. In a way, you control some part of it, but a lot of it I had no control over, and it was okay, because I felt a lot like this person, this Bobby Gold. I even told David when we wrapped the film that of all the characters I've played for him, this was the one I was going to miss the most because I liked the man very much.
Yet you seem so different from him. I mean, you've been married a long time. You have two children. You seem to really, you know, like having a family. Everybody, you know, when I read about you, everybody has such wonderful things to say about you and how you'd never say anything bad about anybody else and how nobody has anything bad to say about you. Well, so it seems like such the opposite picture of this kind of isolated, alienated fellow that you play.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I enjoy my life. I mean, my family, my friends, I feel I live a very fortunate life, and I feel blessed to have that life. But yet I think all of us, even those of us who have been so fortunate to have had, you know, a wonderful life, there is that little bit in them, that isolated thing, that almost not quite sure how to phrase it, but it's like you're born alone and you die alone, that almost kind of thing in you that says, I mean, we used to joke about it with a phrase of, hey, you know, we're all in this alone. And there's some truth to that. So it's just tapping on that and expanding on it and creating a character who's pretty much wrapped around in my case, let's say the Joe Mantegna, who's been had these very lonely, isolated moments in his life, and just stringing them together and saying, "Now this is a guy who's had a hell of a lot more of them."
Can you think of one of those moments that you're thinking of in your life that you'd be able to share publicly?
Well, I actually, as I'm thinking about it now, I remember it was about 20 years ago. I just starting off my professional career as an actor. I was in my early 20s. And I remember it was a holiday. I think it was my birthday. That's what it was. It was my birthday, and things were all going actually very well for me. But my birthday's in November in Chicago. That's a pretty cold month. And for whatever reasons, and I can't even remember specifically why, there was nobody around for my birthday. And I remember I was in my apartment, and it wasn't a bad time in my life. As I said, I was working, things were happening, but for whatever reasons, there was nobody around. I wasn't involved with anybody at that time. And I remember sitting in my apartment, I was eating some tuna fish casserole that I had made for myself. And I remember sitting there eating it thinking, I guess I should be doing something. I should go out somewhere and do something. It's my birthday. I think I was 22, 23 years old. And I remember this terrible feeling of loneliness, of like just wanting to talk to somebody or just share something with somebody. And obviously it did have some impact on me for me to recall what I was even eating at that time.
Yeah.
And to be able to tell you right now. So thinking of moments like that and thinking that this is a character that perhaps has spent a lot of birthdays doing that and a lot of holidays doing that, that helps you really tap into certain kinds of feelings for, you know, the character, a guy who basically lives for his career, who lives for his job, and that's the only thing that gets all of his attention, and everything else is just his own personal life is a long string of eating tuna casseroles by himself.
I want to ask you about your role in Godfather 3. You played Joey Zaza, the gangster with the finest suits, and he's taken over the illegitimate Corleone business interests, and his people are dealing drugs, and he's basically going to war with the Corleone family. I thought you had exactly the right amount of kind of menace and style and all that kind of like public relations flair that that certain gangsters have.
Well, I felt that Francis, in a way like Mamet, writes and directs in a certain kind of a style. And for me, his style is almost operatic and almost regal. I mean, there's a scene in Godfather 3. It's a scene that I'm in and at the it's supposed to be a meeting of all the dons in Atlantic City. And there's a scene where they're passing around a table with jewelry and they're each picking, you know, rings or whatever things of value is to be taking as tribute almost, as gifts. I mean, that scene itself to me struck me as being so ancient Rome or something right out of, you know, the Renaissance. It had a majesty to it. And to me, that was how I tried to key into my character, that even though it's very contemporary, it's, you know, it's now, it's America, it's this world of gangsters and, you know, cops and robbers and whatever. But yet underneath that, there's a certain kind of style and sense of almost, you know, regal royalty kind of thing. You know, these are the princes and dukes and earls of this profession. And that's what I found really interesting about it.
A lot of people assume that the Joey Zaza character that you played in Godfather 3 was in part modeled on John Gotti because they're both, you know, the mobsters with the best wardrobe, you know, with the finest suits. Did you look at any Gotti news clips or anything like that?
No, because I never used Gotti as my, you know, role model for the role. I mean, if people wanted to make those assumptions, that's fine. But my feeling was it goes much broader than that. I mean, that's an obvious comparison you could make, but yet those kinds of characters in gangland lore have existed a lot longer than the current, you know, John Gotti thing. I mean, you know, Bugsy Siegel was a very, you know, dapper, well-dressed guy. And so the clothes are different, but basically the demeanor is basically the same. You know, in other words, a guy who wears $2,000 suits is going to walk and talk and act a little differently than a guy who's wearing stuff from Kmart.
Did you know any guys who had $2,000 suits?
Oh, yeah. I know guys who have $2,000 suits. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Cicero, Illinois, so there was a lot of guys with $2,000 suits walking around. But, you know, it's helpful in the sense of being, I think, being able to recall drawing on that image of guys who dressed very expensively who seemed to have nothing to do at 3 o'clock in the afternoons on weekdays, you know. So I always used to struck me as being very incongruous. It's just like, gee, my dad's at work. I wonder why he isn't.
You seem to be at a new stage in your career. You're much better known than you were, you know, just a couple of years ago. Is there a difference in the kind of screenplays you're being sent now and the types of roles that you're being asked to read?
Well, somewhat. I mean, I'm certainly getting more offers to do, you know, what I would have considered leading man roles, you know, years ago. And also, since I wasn't doing leading man roles years ago, it is kind of new for me. I still think of them. I think of any role as a character role, though. If it's a leading, what someone else would call a leading man role, in my attitude is, well, it's a character role of a leading man. Because that's just my background. I've played all kinds of character roles all my life. So there, you know, there's more often there's roles where I get to kiss the girl, you know, which I, instead of shoot the girl, you know, which I perhaps had a bigger career doing. So it's, again, it's an ongoing evolution.
One last question. What's the difference between playing a leading man as a leading man and playing a leading man as a character actor?
Less makeup, I guess. That's all. You know, I usually tend to just walk on the set and say, no makeup here. Just, you know, just let me know if my hair's in my eyes and, you know, cover maybe this one little blemish that, you know, looks like it's ready to go. Outside of that, let's just wing it, you know.
You have a say in that? I'm surprised.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think when you're first starting out as an actor, you're willing to, like, just trust everybody and say, oh, yeah, go ahead, do what you will with me and throw me out there, and I'll just, you know, and I won't say a word, and hopefully you'll just pay me and send me home. I think later on, as you start to do it, you realize, hey, look, regardless of everybody else's input, it's your mug that's up there for, you know, maybe 50 years from now. As I'm looking at the old Bogart movies, some other little kid's going to be looking at my movies and say, that's that Joe Mantegna. Yeah, oh, yeah, we heard he was an actor back in the, you know, the 90s. So that's what he looked like, kind of, you know. So, no, I think it's important you have a say in that somewhat, you know.
And you don't want somebody looking at it 50 years from now saying, but how come he was wearing eyeliner under his eyes?
Yes, exactly. Jesus, you know, he doesn't seem the type to be wearing that much makeup. So, yeah, I think it's important to have some input.
Joe Mantegna, recorded in 1991. He's now starring in Searching for Bobby Fischer. This is Fresh Air. A hotel has collapsed in Thailand. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on the casualties on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll talk with a BBC reporter in that town in Thailand. The hotel collapsed possibly because too many extra floors had been added to that structure. Many people have been killed, and hundreds are said to have been hurt. We'll have a report on Pope John Paul II, his relationship with young Catholics on our program. Also, Father Guido Sarducci reports on the Pope's visit to Denver. Rosemary Mahoney, who visited Ireland to explore her heritage to write a book called Whoredom in Kimmage, is on our program. We'll have a discussion about the role of the church in Ireland. In her view, it's been repressive.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've heard interviews from our archives today with Joe Mantegna and Larry Fishburne, two stars of the new film Searching for Bobby Fischer. A lot of people are saying this film will be August's big sleeper. It was made by a first-time director, Steve Zaillian, who wrote Awakenings and The Falcon and the Snowman. Film critic Stephen Schiff says sleepers these days are packaged and marketed as cynically as blockbusters.
By any normal standard, this is a pretty good movie. Thoughtful, cleverly told, moving, well-acted, and with enough directorial finesse to mark Steve Zaillian as someone to watch. So, is it just the old curmudgeon in me that kept saying, oh, come off it? Searching for Bobby Fischer is based on an amiable book by a journalist named Fred Waitzkin, who's played by Joe Mantegna in the film. Waitzkin's son Josh is 16 now, and the highest-ranking chess player of his age in the United States. But Searching for Bobby Fischer is the story of Josh at age 7. About how he discovered chess among the hustlers who play it in New York's Washington Square Park, and how he quickly turned out to be a chess prodigy. In the movie, Josh is played by a touching and expressive little actor named Max Pomerantz, who is himself a chess whiz. And the story is mostly about how Josh is buffeted by all the influences working on him. by his dad, who gets too caught up in wanting his kid to win, by his chess teacher, played by Ben Kingsley, and by Vinny, played by Lawrence Fishburne. He's a chess hustler who takes Josh under his wing. The movie works like a sports picture. The underdog who turns out to be a phenom, who rises to great heights and then clutches and slumps because the urge to win at any cost has cut into his humanity. Dad has to stop pushing so hard, and the austere Ben Kingsley character has to step out of the way so that Josh can rediscover his love for the game again. He has to, you know, embrace life. He's been forbidden from playing with Vinny, but as any seasoned moviegoer knows, white middle-class types often need black underclass types in order to learn how to, you know, embrace life. So Josh goes back to the park, and Vinny coaches him through a game.
You're playing not to lose, Josh. You've got to risk losing. You've got to risk everything. You've got to go to the edge of defeat. That's where you want to be, boy, on the edge of defeat.
But
what? Play. Never play the board, always the man. You got to play the man playing the board. Play me. I'm your opponent. You have to beat me, not the board. Beat me.
You're not who I play.
You're playing me now. Come on, beat me. Move. Better. Better. All right. Better, yes. Come on, move. Good. Yeah. All right.
It all sounds very Chariots of Fire. You've got the picture. One of the movie's most effective devices is the way it shows formidable grown-ups like Joe Mantegna, Lawrence Fishburne, and Ben Kingsley, all of whom give terrific performances, treating Josh with enormous respect, even though he's a little kid with a messy room and a lot of toys and a passion for baseball. Except, after a while, you may start to notice that the Josh we're watching isn't really a little kid at all. He's a grown-up with little kid trappings, infinitely wiser and more dignified than the adults around him. Could the real Josh ever have been such a controlled and mannerly little saint? Of course not. Read the book and Josh the human emerges, and he's much more interesting. The movie betrays its subject by taming it to death. It turns Josh into an idealized child who teaches the grown-ups how to be as mature as he is. And along the way, the whole enterprise picks up an awful, sanctimonious glow. Searching for Bobby Fischer isn't a bad movie, but it's a slick, phony one. What could have been interesting and quirky has been turned into that dull thing, a Hollywood sleeper.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reef is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mary Elizabeth Frick lives on a Missouri hog farm. But just as her book is about to come out, describing taking piglets from 600-pound angry sows and driving monster tractors with 16 gears, her farm is underwater. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about life on a hog farm during the Mississippi flood. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.